Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, the search on Earth for the Garden of Eden.
Then, of course, after Adam and Eve, you know, sin, God floods the Garden of Eden and it freezes. And that's how we get the North Pole today.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Tony Bentley explores the vanished world of Bloomsbury.
It is a book full of a wistfulness and it's very elegiac. It is not, however, sad. He's an extremely funny writer, among other things.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. I'm really bad at coming up with titles for my own books, so I'm hugely envious that my guest today has chosen one of the best titles I've read in years. It's called Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden. The author is Brooke Walensky Lanford, and it's reviewed, raved over by Andrea Wolfe, who says Paradise Lust is strangely wonderful and a pleasure to read, that Walensky Lanford tackles her subject with an appealing mix of serious research and tongue-in-cheek humor. I'm delighted that Brooke is here to talk about it. Brooke, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. So this is a nonfiction book. There are actually seriously intelligent, thoughtful people over the course of centuries who have searched for the Garden of Eden. And it actually, your interest in this book began with a relative of yours.
Yeah. My great uncle, who I had never met, I heard a rumor through my father that he had been looking for the Garden of Eden. And all I knew about this guy was that he was an allergist at the Columbia University Medical Center. He lived on the Upper East Side. He was a scientist. And so this struck me as very odd that he would be looking for a biblical place on Earth.
And really looking for.
Really looking.
Searching all over the place.
Yeah. The closest I got to figuring out where he actually went was that he had a cousin who was a pilot, and they were going to fly to the site and look for signs of the garden. So they really had a plan to actually go and see a physical place. I never actually did find out where my great uncle thought that this site was, but it really sparked my interest to see who else was looking and where, you know, this was in the 1950s that he was looking. Where did people think it was then? How did that come about? How did anyone, you know, look at the Bible and think they're talking about a real place? And it turns out that ever since, there's certainly medieval goes all the way back, but ever since the 20th century, different people have been looking and seriously looking in real places all over the world for the Garden of Eden. So it was a major surprise to me and really sparked my curiosity to find out more.
And it became a kind of life's mission for some of these people. They thought they would really find it. Who were some of the most enterprising searchers for the Garden of Eden?
I think when I think of enterprising, I think of Zay Swantai, and I'm going to badly mispronounce his name, Chinese entrepreneur and businessman during World War I who followed the recent discoveries in Outer Mongolia that was still a sort of new area of exploration and came up with this really wild theory about how the Garden of Eden had started, you know, in Chinese territory, and it was really a Chinese story. So that took a lot of sort of guts and entrepreneurial spirit, I think. Maybe one of the most prominent of the Eden seekers would be the first president of Boston University. He was William Fairfield Warren. He was a Methodist theologian in the late 19th century who came up with this theory that the Garden of Eden had been at the North Pole, which, again, was just sort of being explored. Nobody really knew what was there. There was a lot of interest in that part of the world. And he found out this one true fact that way back in prehistoric millions of years ago, the North Pole had been warmer. This is actually true, right? So he takes this and he spins it into that, you know, this was this tropical paradise and everything, all the trees and plants were of giant size and there were giant people up there. And he concocts this whole origin story for the whole of humanity starting at the North Pole, which then, of course, after Adam and Eve, you know, sin, God floods the Garden of Eden, and it freezes, and that's how we get the North Pole today.
So you're actually looking at convergence of some huge things that are going on here. One is that in a very serious, plausible way, there were these remarkable discoveries being made about the actual planet we live on, And a thoughtful, creative person then kind of attaches that to these this huge biblical myth, and there might be some kind of revelation at the end of this. It doesn't sound so crazy, really.
Really? Yeah, no, it's definitely a creative endeavor. It's a sort of a mix of someone will start with one fact or one belief and try and merge it with their ideas of with their religious ideas. So they're taking their religious ideas and trying to make them fit what's actually real and what's new and what's being discovered. So this was not, you know, I first started out thinking, well, how strange for a scientist like my great uncle to be looking for something religious, and those two things, you know, have a history of clashing. But it turns out that these are people who are really invested in both ways of looking at the world, invested in science and invested in religion, and trying to make the two, sort of knit the two together in these really interesting, you know, and sort of far out ways.
Well, you write about one of the great 19th century American scientists at Harvard, Louis Agassiz, who was a hugely influential figure.
He was very influential. He sort of walked that line of – he was a believing Christian and also a major – one of his major advances was in geology. He sort of figured out when and how the last ice age had come about. At the time, this was controversial because there was still a widespread belief – this was in the, I believe, 1880s – there was still a widespread belief that the last major change in the Earth's crust had been after Noah's flood.
Well, he was kind of a precursor to Darwin in some ways.
He was. So, you know, what I think is interesting about him is that he would certainly say that, you know, glaciers come from God, you know, but also was – Darwin considered him, you know, an ally and certainly a sort of companion in that.
Now, what about today? Are there still people searching for Eden now?
Yes. Certainly the search has changed. You know, we're now past the great age of exploration that brought people to Outer Mongolia and the North Pole. So the search has definitely changed, and it's gotten, as I say in the book, in the 1920s, after sort of the Scopes trial era, it got a lot weirder, even weirder than the North Pole. We have people creating sort of out of whole cloth a story about aliens that came from a previous universe. We have Joseph Smith, who back in the 1830s was prophesizing about where Adam and Eve had been in the United States. And the whole, you know, Mormon church now follows these very specific pronouncements about where the Garden of Eden is. So we have major, you know, tourist sites in parts of Missouri that are supposed to be the Garden of Eden. So it's still present.
Has any harm come from these searches for Eden?
You know, no. I don't think any harm has come. I think actually a lot of good can be said to have come from these searches. Like the Chinese person I was talking about earlier, he really had this idea that the Garden of Eden could bring people together. You know, here was this unclaimed territory, and if he could prove that that was where humanity began, then he wanted to build like an international world peace, you know, government. This was in the middle of World War I. So he had this idea of bringing people together over the Garden of Eden. That's a theme that you find throughout, is the Garden of Eden is for everybody, right? It's not an exclusive. It's like, where did we all begin? And, you know, which is kind of a – it's a kind of nice way to look at the world, as it turns out.
Yeah. There's a utopian aspect to a lot of this, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this perfect place, you know, where we all began, and we'd like to get back there.
And you're telling me it's not in New Jersey.
Well, that's where I live, so I like to think so.
Thanks a lot, Brooke.
Thank you.
That's Brooke Wilensky-Lanford, whose new book, Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the endless saga of borders continues.
Yes.
What's next?
One of the last chapters of the borders story. This week, borders revealed in a routine court filing that they have fired their president, Mike Edwards, and their CFO, Scott Henry. This is sort of one of the final housekeeping moves of the borders saga.
Okay, Julie, so we know it's dissolving. We've been following the story. And other bookstores or book chains like Barnes & Noble will actually take over some of the stores and inventory the books too?
Yes, there are a few stores that so far we know will be taken over. Books A Million has said that it will take over a couple of stores. They initially said that they wanted to take over 30 or more stores, but those talks fell through. So it looks like in small cases across the country, people who only had a Borders store will still have another store to go to.
Julie, I was talking to a publisher the other day who told me that Borders was so shaky, he had essentially stopped dealing with them a few years ago. Is that true for a number of publishers?
It's especially true of smaller and mid-sized publishers. The large publishers kept dealing with Borders up until the very end, although they did keep them at arm's length. They abandoned their usual trade terms, which allowed Borders to receive books first and then pay later. The terms that the large publishers had imposed on Borders were, if you want a shipment of books, you're going to pay for it in cash up front. Now, smaller or mid-sized publishers, for them, it was a totally different story. They could not afford to take a big risk on Borders, so a lot of smaller publishers said, you know, I stopped shipping books to Borders years ago because, you know, if I would lose $5 million, like, that would put me out of business. I couldn't begin to afford to lose that much money. So Borders was just too risky of a proposition for a lot of smaller publishers.
And for some of the bigger ones, if they're producing huge numbers of copies of particular books, then they need bookstores to put them all in, right? They actually have more books out there than maybe a smaller or mid-sized publisher would.
Right. Even in this day where print runs are much smaller, larger publishers depended on Borders when they kind of projected how many copies of a certain book they were going to print. They included Borders. Naturally, that has kind of decreased in the last few months and years as publishers realized that sales at Borders were just really falling precipitously.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, the Bloomsbury Circle and people on its fringes and connected with it one way or another remain fascinating subjects for study and contemplation. And there's a new book on the subject by one of the great living biographers, Michael Holroyd. The book is called A Book of Secrets, Illegitimate Daughters, Absent Fathers. It's reviewed for us by one of our favorites, Tony Bentley, who I'm delighted to say is joining us by telephone from California to talk about it. Hi, Tony.
Hi there, Sam. Nice to be with you.
These were extraordinary figures. Tell us about some of the women, the lesser lives, as Holroyd ironically describes them, who are at the heart of this last book of his.
Well, one of the ones that I'm especially fond of, her name is Eve Fairfax. She's most notable for being one of Rodin's favorite models. She posed for him for over 8 years, and they had a long relationship, though platonic, that Holroyd says was probably the most tender and lasting of her life. She was sent to pose for Rodin by her then-fiancé, Ernest Beckett, who is a very interesting figure in Holroyd's book also. But she ended up without the husband, but with a bust, which she then had to sell. She asked Rodin if she could sell it when she was destitute. He said yes. He told her that she should get, I think, about £800 at the time for it. She sold it to a South African art gallery. But the money didn't last long. She lived till 106. She never married, though she had many admirers, and it's a very poignant tale.
Tony, one of the points Holroyd makes, and that you do in your review, is that these were remarkable women, and many of the major subjects here are, whose lives and opportunities were kind of lived against the strictures and restrictions of the time. What was their world like? These kind of minor aristocrats at the turn of the 20th century or late 19th century, how did they become exceptional people given the world they were born into?
very much either succumbing to the restrictions of the time or, as in the case of Violet Trefusis, who is the main focus, really, of Holroyd's book, by rebelling against it. Now, she rebelled in the way of being a lesbian. And, you know, she had mothers and husbands and all kinds of people trying to rein her in, but she was passionately in love with Vita Sackville-West, and Vita was in love with her. And they did it really through rebellion, these two women. And it's an amazing story. It's been told many times before, but Holroyd really puts it into an incredible perspective with an incredible excitement to it. This is a story that I read about when I was 16 years old, and there have been books before about it, many, and it's an incredibly exciting story of women straining against convention that I found it a great inspiration as a teenager myself.
Tony, you mention in the review, and Holroyd himself is quite direct about this, he's very possibly the most admired and accomplished literary biographer of our time. He's dying now and says this is the last book he's written. Is there a flavor of elegy, even of a kind of terminal quality to this book? Does this book cap his career in some way?
I think it does, in that it's a small book, unlike some of his great studies of George Bernard Shaw, for example, but it is a book full of a wistfulness, and it's very elegiac. It is not, however, sad. He's an extremely funny writer, among other things. He tells a story in the book of going to the Villa Cimbrone, the place that Ernest Beckett bought and loved in Italy, and tells a laugh-out-loud, hilarious tale of driving there with a woman, Catherine Till, who believed she might be the granddaughter of Ernest Beckett. So there's a great deal of joy in this book as well. It's also interesting, he has written, of course, about women before, as in his very last book about Ellen Terry, but his great big books have been about men, and this one is so focused on these lives of women that it certainly made me wish that he had written more about women before he stopped writing. He has an incredible empathy for them and great compassion. And while he says only on the very last page that it's his last book, it is not done in any kind of sad way, really. And he also injects himself in a very interesting, wonderful way into the book, talking about, pulling out a little into present day, telling us about his research, how he came to find Eve Fairfax, which was by seeing the bust of her by Rodin and becoming interested in her as a woman. And so it's very interesting to see his process that he shares with us in a very, very charming way.
In the book, he has a brief discussion of the great biographer Lytton Strachey, who wrote Eminent Victorians, and of course is a subject of one of Holroyd's major biographies. Is Holroyd himself in some ways a descendant of Strachey? Is he reanimating biography along the lines Strachey did of drama and wit and psychological portraiture?
I think so, absolutely. And yes, by getting very much inside these people, we feel very intimate with them. And I think he was a great believer in the detail, the possibly uninteresting detail being very, very telling. So he gets in very, very close with his people. And I think he so appreciates them, so researches them, that he speaks almost for them, for us, rather than a sort of distant academic attitude. I think I read that he said something wonderful to a reviewer at one point, or an interviewer perhaps, that one should never use the first names of one's subjects. And then he proceeded to use nothing but first names, which I followed his lead in my review. And I think that's a very telling detail of how he brings us in so close to these people in a way and with enormous wit.
Thanks so much, Tony.
Thank you, Sam. Nice talking to you.
That's Tony Bentley, who this week reviews A Book of Secrets, Illegitimate Daughters, Absent Fathers, on the cover of the book review. Jennifer Schuessler's with Best Selling News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, not a lot of news on the nonfiction list. In fact, there are no new books on the list this week. J.C. Dugard is still on top with her memoir, A Stolen Life, followed by Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken, Eric Larson's In the Garden of Beasts, and so on. It's just kind of the same books in slightly different order. I don't know if this is people settling into their lounge chairs or people on the Titanic rearranging the deck chairs. I don't know. A couple somewhat older titles are sort of popping back up again, though. You might remember a couple of weeks ago I talked about the neuroscientist David Eagleman. He has a new book out called Incognito. It's about some sort of mysterious properties of the unconscious mind. And he sort of disappeared from view for a bit, and now he's popped back up in the last 2 weeks, sort of like a guilty thought.
What about fiction?
George R.R. Martin has lost his grip on the top spot. His book, A Dance with Dragons, drops down to number 2. He's been replaced with Jim Butcher's Ghost Story. This is sort of the umpteenth in Butcher's series about Harry Dresden, the wizard detective in Chicago. And Danielle Steele celebrates her 70th bestseller with her latest. It is called Happy Birthday.
Her 70th.
Yes, I have always wondered how many books she has had on the list. Going into our database, it's actually sort of laborious to count. And this week, our wonderful people in graphics decided to do all the work, and they came up with 70. I'm not sure that's a number even Danielle Steele would like to admit to.
Wow. Well, you know, she was a guest on the program once, and she was terrific.
I remember.
So you've told us about some fixtures on the list. Any new faces or names?
There's one very interesting book, a book I like a lot, by a first-time author. It is called Rules of Civility by Amor Towles, and it squeaks onto the list at number 16. I've been complaining a lot in recent weeks about how tough it is for first-time authors to make the list at all. And this is this very literary novel. It's about a young Wall Street secretary in the late 30s who sort of falls in with this set of upper-class bright young things and sort of gets whisked into this glamorous New York life. It's been getting great reviews. It's going to be reviewed in the book review next week. And Towles has kind of an interesting history. He is in his mid-40s. He is actually a money manager, quite successful. And he came to, he's sort of a little bit of the reverse of his heroine. He came to New York in the late 80s, hoping to be a writer, and noticed that all of his friends who had artistic aspirations were sort of too busy working as waiters and becoming totally exhausted to get anything done. So he decided to go into finance, did well for himself, but kind of never gave up on his dreams. And, you know, here he is 20 years later with a bestseller.
Great story. Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.